morning, Cascadia. You're listening to your community radio station, KBOO, Portland, Oregon, at 90.7 FM. Today's Friday, March 20th. That's Nowruz, Zoroastrian New Year, 2009. And this is Air Cascadia. Long on content, short on time. I'm Chris Andre.
And I'm Liam Delta.
Now the feds have come on board with Oregon on appealing FERC's ill-conceived Bradwood LNG approval.
Bonuses aren't the only corporate hanky-panky. Many of these same beneficiaries haven't paid taxes for a while.
The House passes a bill to tax the people who got the bonuses, but will the legislation serve only to stampede an already nervous herd?
Portland area weather, rain in the north, highs in the 50s. Tonight, a chance of showers, lows in the mid-30s to low 40s. Tomorrow, wet with isolated thunderstorms and a little cooler.
And first we go to regional news from around Cascadia. Oregon Attorney General John Kroger says the U.S. Department of Justice has joined Oregon in appealing the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission's approval of the proposed Bradwood Landing liquefied gas terminal on the Columbia River. My guest, Dan Sears of Columbia Riverkeeper, has been fighting the LNG menace for many years and joins us this morning to talk about this latest development. Good morning, Dan. Thanks for being with us.
Morning, Chris.
So, this is yet another, well, this time it's the feds are getting on board with the efforts to stop Bradwood from being developed. What does it mean? Where do we go now?
Well, it's very significant that a federal agency is challenging the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission's approval of the Bradwood project. They're not alone in seeing the decision as flawed. They're joining Oregon, the state of Oregon, the state of Washington, and other groups, obviously, like Columbia Riverkeeper, who think that FERC's decision to approve Bradwood just defied common sense and defied the law. So what NMFS is doing, the National Marine Fisheries Service, is they're standing up and they're arguing that, you know, the federal law is not being followed by FERC's decision. So this will be decided by the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals in the next, hopefully, several months.
And pending that appeal, can Northern Star start working at Bradwood?
We don't think so. Bradwood lacks necessary approvals, not just from, not just because they have a license that's under challenge by a federal agency, but also because they lack necessary approval at the state level. So we're going to be watching closely to make sure that Bradwood doesn't try to move forward with moving any ground. We think that the project isn't viable as proposed, and we're definitely going to be looking at the Ninth Circuit to overturn the very ill-conceived approval of the Bradwood project by FERC.
Thank you so much for that. My guest has been Dan Sears of the Columbia Riverkeeper. Again, thank you so much, Dan.
Thank you, Chris.
Former Oregon State University marine biologist Jane Lubchenco is the new head of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration as of yesterday. She said science, not politics, will guide the agency as it confronts global warming, declining fisheries, and forecasting natural disasters. Lubchenco expects her agency, which is part of the Commerce Department, to play a role in creating jobs in coastal areas where half the country's population lives and developing a green economy.
But we're still not out of the wilderness. So for the second time this year, the Senate has passed a long-delayed bill to set aside more than 2 million acres in 9 states as protected wilderness. The 77-20 vote yesterday sends the bill to the House, where final legislative approval could come as early as next week. The Senate first approved the measure back in January, but the House rejected it last week amid a partisan dispute over, wait for it, gun rights. The gun issue is not raised during the Senate debate.
You want the good news? The Portland area's growth put the region on a track to add 1 million people in the next 20 years. Thanks to the recession, growth is expected to slow, and if we're very lucky, even stop. But look out, because here come the climate change refugees. Metro economist Dennis Yee still believes the greater Portland area will add 1 million people by 2030 and will double in population by 2060.
Someone has gone and shot the bluebird of happiness, and it's us. Researchers were shocked when they counted breeding tufted puffins along the Oregon coast last summer, from well over 6,000 puffins back in 79 to a rough count of just 142 last year. The decline mirrors some of the grim news in a report released by the Interior Department showing that almost a third of the 800 bird species in the United States are endangered or in decline from habitat loss, invasive species, and to climate change. And need we ask what we refer to by invasive species? That would be us.
The Oregon legislature is considering the biggest suite of changes to the state's fabled bottle bill since it was adopted 38 years ago. The potential changes include doubling the nickel deposit, adding redemption centers that would take some of the load off of the grocery stores, and requiring deposits on more containers. But the changes won't come without a fight.
And it's not like this just turned up yesterday, but yesterday jurors in the W.R. Grace environmental trial in Missoula, Montana, heard evidence that a 1977 chest X-ray study of a group of Libby miners showed a high incidence of asbestos-related disease. Dr. Daniel Teitelbaum is a toxicologist who oversaw the study commissioned by Grace. He was paid by Grace, and he found the disease. Teitelbaum testified that Grace did not follow up on the chest study as recommended by his radiologists.
In Arlington, Washington, a woman accused of taking more than $73,000 from the church where she worked blames the devil. Papers filed with a theft charge Wednesday in Snohomish County Superior Court say Colin Okeson told detectives she guessed Satan had a big part in the theft.
The Lord take us and the Lord give it away. My guest this morning, live here in KBOO Studios, is an enlightened and enthusiastic proponent of sustainable systems, an investigative journalist and environmental activist. Gordon Mackay-Westfall joins us on the air today to kick off a discussion of water in the Pacific Northwest. Greetings, Gordon. Welcome to the KBOO Airwaves.
Good morning.
Water, that's the big question.
Yes, well, water is a big question, and I was listening to an interview on Wednesday, the 2 days ago, and they were talking about the Willamette. And what really got my cry is that Ross Island is actually bringing dredge from a polluted, nuclear-polluted river, the Columbia River, and bringing it to the Willamette. So we really need to look at what we're doing to our water, and I just go, wait a second, what are we doing bringing pollutant from one place to another? And it's just, you know, dealing with the isotopes in one river is hard enough, you know, so...
As if the Willamette River needs any more pollution.
I know. It doesn't need any more pollution, and, you know, it's... We really need to work on... getting these guys responsible for what they're doing, you know, because we need to clean it up, not get it more polluted.
Well, what do you see the chances of? This is, of course, every Portlander's dream is to swim in the Willamette River right across, right at Waterfront Park. Any chance of that in the future?
Well, wouldn't that be nice? Well, it's the only thing swimming is the fish and the oil, really. And I do have to say that I do take an extreme stance on my water. I do believe that water might be it actually is one of the three most important things on the planet, the sun, the water, and the air. I mean, so what are we doing driving boats in our water and spewing more oil and mercury and carcinogens into our water when we should actually be keeping it healthy and clean, because that is our life force. That's mama's blood right there that we live off of. And so we really need to look at some of the stronger things to do about conserving and really protecting our most important resource on the planet.
My guest today has been Gordon Mackay-Westfall of the Center for Sustainable Today. Gordon is going to be probably a regular guest on Air Cascadia. Thank you so much for that.
Thank you so much, and really protect the water.
The House approved a bill that would slap AIG and other beneficiaries of taxpayer largesse with a 90% tax. Of course, the tax would be on the employees, not the actual companies. We all know that corporations don't pay taxes.
President Obama and his Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner are taking plenty of hits over the millions of dollars of bonus payments. But one politician appears to be getting his own PR bonus out of the stink, Senator Ron Wyden. So does Wyden deserve the kudos that has come his way? And that, like any good politician, he has aggressively pursued. His amendment to this bill applied only to bonuses over $100,000, and companies that failed to comply would have been forced to pay back 35% of the excessive amount anyway. None of this has stopped Gordon from cashing in.
Some of the top recipients of U.S. bailout money owe the federal government more than $220 million in unpaid taxes, and these are just from the ones that were checked.
I mean to say Ron Wyden has, in fact, cashed in a public relations manner on the AIG bonuses and the bailouts in general. And now, corporate culture, what is it? Do we have any? Can we get some? What would it look like? Is it expensive, violent, shy? We know it smells bad because we can smell it from here. KBOO Spencer Raymond has been studying this strange bird for at least a week now. Good morning, Spencer.
Good morning, Chris. Yeah, it is. Excuse me. It is an interesting phenomenon here, and it's really been brought to light this week after the bonuses for the AIG executives were made public. And you know, we've always heard throughout this process the bonuses for these executives and this kind of corporate culture that has developed in the upper echelons of American businesses. And you know, when you think about it, these executives are operating on a different level than the regular middle class worker. That's clear. And what I think they've kind of established is once they have gotten to an executive position, once they're serving on boards, day-to-day work is not conducted as the same as most other people. And they are dealing with so much money, they're earning so much money, that they're almost detached from what the real world is actually like on a day-to-day working basis. And so what to the regular American may seem like an outrageous six-figure bonus, especially after a bailout, to them is just, you know, their annual, you know, bonus check that they would expect, you know, in good times or bad.
Yeah, they've become accustomed to its face, haven't they? Accustomed to its smile. So, Spencer, next week, any predictions?
Well, what's up next is the Senate is going to have to vote on the 90% tax for the bonuses. Remember, it was yesterday when the House voted to tax the AIG bonuses and bonuses from similar companies, 90%. The Senate has to weigh in. It's not clear if they're going to do exactly the same, but the outrage is not going anywhere. What is most interesting, I think, is that it's very clear that most of the American people are uncomfortable and angry about this, and the banks are starting to realize this. I mean, the AIG CEO has said that, you know, he recognizes Americans' frustration with this, and so it's kind of a new, there's a new kind of realization going on of what's actually happening inside these banks to a more detailed degree that we really haven't discussed before.
Well, thank you so much for that. It seems that we've been through General Motors, General Electric, and now it's probably time for a general strike. That, of course, was KBOO's reporter, Spencer Raymond. Thank you so much for that, Spencer.
In Iraq today. In Iraq today, thousands of followers of radical Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr called for an end to the U.S. occupation. Neither the Iraqi authorities nor the U.S. military marked the March 20, 2003 invasion. This has been Headlines and Commentary from Air Cascadia for Friday, March 20, 2009. Today's editor is Chris Andre. Engineering is Todd Wilson. The KBOO AM News and Public Affairs Director is Kathleen Stevenson. I'm Liam Delta.
And I'm Chris Andre. You're listening to member-supported KBOO Portland, your community radio at 90.7 FM. Your support and your support only keeps us subverting the dominant paradigm. Thank you so much, members.
Coming up next, Flashpoints. Youth speak out against the war and Palestinian legislator Mustafa Barghouti on the appointment of Avigdor Lieberman as Israel's foreign minister.
Thanks for listening and have a good day.
On flashpoints on the 6th anniversary of the war and occupation of Iraq. Flashpoints will feature a mini speakout by Youth Against the War, who will be a part of major national protests over the weekend. Also, Palestinian legislator and physician Dr. Mustafa Barghouti comments on the expansion of Israeli settler power with the appointment of Avigdor Lieberman to the post of Israel's foreign minister. That's right, a settler as foreign minister. Plus, Flashpoints continues our coverage of the Oscar Grant murder with an interview with the grandmother of Tatiana, the daughter of Oscar Grant. We'll have the Night Report. I'm Dennis Bernstein with Nora Barrows Friedman. All this straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein, and now we go to New York City for the Night Report in Exile with Robert Knight.
In today's Night Report, African leaders reject a Malagasy coup, and more troops and advisors are slated for Afghanistan. I'm Robert Knight in New York. The Southern African Development Community today has threatened the new rulers of Madagascar with sanctions unless they return the country to constitutional rule. The regional leaders of Southern Africa refused to recognize the new nominal president, Andry Rajoelina, following his taking of power with the cooperation of the Madagascar military. In a strongly worded statement, the SADC today said that, quote, his appointment not only violates the Constitution of Madagascar and democratic principles, but violates the core principles and treaty of the SADC, the African Union, and the United Nations Charter, end quote. Their statement was issued after a regional summit in Swaziland. That summit included member states Angola, Botswana, Lesotho, Malawi, Mozambique, Swaziland, the United Republic of Tanzania, Zambia, and Zimbabwe. Elsewhere in the world, NATO officials today announced plans for thousands more troops being sent to Afghanistan to enforce an election that is currently scheduled for August. There are already more than 60,000 troops, including some 40,000 American soldiers, in Afghanistan. They're there to prop up the foreign-installed regime of Hamid Karzai, the nominal president and longtime CIA asset. The constantly shifting election date, which has now been moved to August after Karzai failed in an attempt to run as early as next month, is in violation of Afghanistan's foreign-imposed constitution. Under that constitution, the presidential election should have been held between 1 and 2 months before Karzai's term was supposed to have ended on May 22nd. But Karzai has not announced whether he will in fact step down in May. The opposition is calling for the appointment of a so-called caretaker administration until the postponed election, and the so-called Independent Election Commission blamed its rescheduling and violations of constitutional law on security fears and logistical problems. And finally, a leading Iraqi Sunni politician and an ally of Iraq's U.S.-installed governing coalition there has been assassinated west of Baghdad. Faisal Abdallah al-Samarai was among the top leaders of the Iraqi Islamic Party. He was gunned down overnight as he left the celebration of Muhammad's birth. He was recently elected to a local council in the district of Al-Kark, just west of Baghdad. His assassination is the latest in a series of attacks on Sunni leaders whom jihadis have accused of collaborating with the Shia-dominated government headed by the U.S.-installed Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki. And that's some of the news of this Thursday, March 19, 2009. From Exile in New York, I'm Robert Knight for Flashpoints.
In Berkeley, I'm Dennis Bernstein. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. And we continue our coverage of the close-range police murder of Oscar Grant by BART police here in Oakland, California. In one moment, we will be joined by Larry Everest again to go over the details of this killing and the cover-up and to talk about some significant actions that are happening. But we are honored and delighted, really, to be joined by Rosemary Mesa. She is the grandmom of Tatiana. That was the daughter, is the daughter of Oscar Grant, and she's the mom of Sophina, and that's Oscar's girlfriend. So it is so good to have you with us. I have to say, we've never spoken on air before, but I am very sorry for your loss and the suffering that this has brought to your family.
Well, I just want to say thank you for all your support that your station has done for Oscar and my granddaughter, and as well as Oscar's family. I'm really grateful for all the...
Well, thank you. Thank you very much. And we wish we could do more, but we're going to be telling people a lot about this tribunal coming up on Sunday. But let me ask you how you think the investigation is going and what are some of your concerns. I know that you're a little afraid that this is going to be covered up and shuffled under the rug.
Correct. One of my greatest fears is I know that it was stated, if I'm not mistaken, by the independent investigation that Bart has hired, that they have 40 witnesses. Well, I kind of wonder where these 40 witnesses came from. If you look on the videos, the train was sent away with all the witnesses. So I'm kind of wondering where they got them from. I think the only people that you can find credible would probably be the people that turned in the videos, as well as the boys on the platform, because anybody could walk up and say they were there. So I'm kind of wondering where these 40 came from.
Well, it is, you mentioned that train car full of people who were eyewitnesses that the BART police, the killers on the scene, really shuffled out of the station before they even thought about, if they ever did, really call in this kill that they had just carried out. So they really wanted to get rid of that train car. So I understand your concern there. I'm wondering, have you felt that all these, the independent investigation and the prosecutors now, have really tried to reach out to the witnesses who you think have the story to tell, the ones who were the closest, who saw what was going on?
No, I don't think so. As of right now, that I know of, no one has been contacted to even give their testimony. So it's kind of funny that, you know, I'm not sure how they're going to present this or how they're going to even come out, because everyone that I know of has not been questioned. So, you know, it's kind of scary. But that's why we need everyone's support. That's why we need to keep this in the media to receive justice for Oscar. It's very important. We need every person. Every person does matter. They count when they support us. And when we see faces at the tribunal and we don't know them, that, believe it or not, helps the healing for all of us, because we know that we're not out there alone and that people do care and people are supporting us. So it's very important to us, and we thank everyone for their support.
And we want to tell people, first of all, we're speaking with Rosemary Mesa. She is the grandmama of Tatiana, the daughter of Oscar Grant, who was murdered by BART police on New Year's Day. And she's the mom of Sophina. That's Oscar's girlfriend, and we're talking about a tribunal that's going to happen on Sunday, March 22nd. We're going to be talking more with Larry about this, but I know that you are going to be there, Rosemary Mesa. And what would you like to say to people? Because I know you want them to come. Why do you want them to be there? And why is it important, do you think, for people to learn a lot more about the case now?
Well, I think it's important for one, because if Meserly gets away with murder, and he did commit a vicious act of murder, he is a policeman, or excuse me, was. I'm not quite sure how that goes, but, you know, the world's seen this on video. And if a cop can get away with this on video, we are all in trouble. Every single one of us are in trouble, because basically that is putting a statement out there that anybody, especially the policeman, can get away with murder even when it's caught on video. And that's kind of scary. I really do want to see new faces at the tribunal. It's very important that we have this support, not just for us and for Oscar Grant, but for the next persons and the people that have been through this, that, you know, they've suffered vicious acts of violence in their family by police, and no one heard them, and they couldn't prove it, and, you know, that's sad, and it's in a sense blessing that it was caught on video, because I'm sure, and you know as well as I do, they were trying to cover this up, but they couldn't. And it's there, it's out in the open, and it's very important that we all stand together. And every, like I said earlier, every face, every person matters in the support for the justice of Oscar Grant.
All right. Well, we know that you will be there Sunday, and I also know that you will be in the courtroom with your daughter on Monday, because that's when, Messerly, that's when Oscar Grant's killer is back in court. I'm sure he's going to have a lot of support from all the cops around, and there'll be
correct.
A lot of uniforms around and a lot of intimidation. So we're going to watch that, and hopefully we can get you and Sophina to come in and speak to us in person, maybe on Monday after the hearing, and we will do our best to stay close and to see what the family is saying about all that is going on, and we'll have more information about the tribunal and where people can participate if they want, just coming up in a few minutes after our interview with Larry Evers. Thank you so much. Again, we are sorry for your loss, Rosemary Mesa, and your daughter, Sophina, and we're going to do the best we can to keep this story going.
Thank you so much for all your support, Dennis.
All right. Take care now.
Okay. Thank you.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. Students and young people around the country will be joining in massive anti-war protests as people demand an end to the six-year war and occupation of Iraq. In a way, students have the most to lose. Many of them end up dying fighting and in the wars of aggression and occupation. And if they don't end up dying, then they lose their rights and benefits to go to school, because the money for school is going to war. Today on Flashpoints, we feature a speak out on how youth, young people have been impacted by these wars, and we're going to tell you, they're going to tell you why they are participating in massive protests in Washington, D.C., Los Angeles, and in San Francisco here in the Bay Area. I'll be with a team from KPFA, Malihe, Nora Barros Friedman, Miguel Gavilan Molina will be producing a three-hour special from the protest site, Civic Center in San Francisco, starting at 1 o'clock on Saturday. And, of course, you can stream us from other parts of the country. Joining us first by telephone is Rawan. She's a high school senior at Santa Clara High, who is also enrolled at Mission College. She is an activist in the South Bay. Marco Madalano also joins us. He's a coordinator of military out of our schools, and we'll be joined by others in just a few minutes. Rawan, let me bring it to you first. Why should young people, why are you engaged in trying to end the six-year war and occupation of Iraq?
Well, I think I'm engaged in this protest against the war basically because it goes against all humanitarian laws and it violates everything that we as humans stand for, and everything that's going towards supporting this war is going from this war is being supported by taxpayers' money, while our economy is completely falling apart. We don't have money for health care. We don't have money for schools. We don't have money for just people's basic needs. People are being unemployed, and there's no money being circulated around. And instead of supporting students and helping them getting educated to bring about progression in our society, instead we're spending billions. We've already spent over $600 billion on Iraq. We've spent billions on the war on Palestine, and Obama wants to spend $200 billion on Iraq and send more troops to Afghanistan. And all this money, I believe, should be going towards schools and things that are for a good cause rather than like hurting innocent people without cause.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're speaking with Rawan, a high school senior at Santa Clara High, also enrolled in some courses at Mission College. She's an activist coming out of the South Bay. I guess, Rawan, you're going to be marching on Saturday, and you're going to be at the rally?
Yeah, I am.
And tell us about the scuttlebutt. What's the if you will, the talk of the town in high school? Are people who you go to school with watching the story? Do they care about this? Does this mean anything to them? Or is there more things that have to do with just hanging out and having fun?
Yeah, people at the high school don't really care about this. When you bring it up, it's more of, oh, this is just politics. It just for. They don't really see it or understand what's going on. They don't feel it, and I don't think they don't get it at all. But I think when you tell them that, like especially seniors right now that aren't getting into college or aren't able to go to college, and you tell them, oh well, you know, maybe you would get some money if the government stopped spending so much money on the war in Iraq or the war in Palestine. Maybe if we were able to give some of those billions of dollars towards scholarships for students and aid, they kind of it brings about, it makes them think about what's going on just a little, even if it doesn't really trigger. It triggers thought, but it doesn't. They don't really care about it as much as they should be.
Rowan, some people say that, you know, you really just need to focus on Iraq and what's going on in Iraq, and that people who get diverted trying to work Palestine into the mix, and, you know, that has nothing to do with it. What's your response to that?
I think this is all Palestine, Iraq, Afghanistan, it's all the same story, and you can't just concentrate on Iraq, and you can't just concentrate on Palestine or just Afghanistan. Our country is involved in all of it, and it's all linked together, and we need to work on all of it, and we need to end the war on, like, all injustices and all wars, no matter where they are. And it's affecting, all of it is affecting us. I mean, Obama wants to double the troops in Afghanistan right now, and these are, the troops don't even know why they're going in to Afghanistan what they're supposed to be doing there. And people don't understand that their money is going from, their tax money is going to pay for weapons to kill innocent civilians in Palestine. They don't know that our money is going, like, for injustices and to occupy Iraq unjustly. And I think we need to concentrate on everything, not just Iraq.
Rawan, a high school student, senior at Santa Clara High, taking some college admission, of course, at Mission College. Also joining the discussion is Marco Madalano. Marco works as a coordinator of military out of our schools. Marco, how deeply is the military still in the schools, and how heavily is recruiting going on now?
I believe a perfect example of how deeply embedded the military is in our schools is with the Pentagon's Junior Reserve Officer Training Corps program, JROTC. It's, you know, it's a program that's meant to track students into becoming officers in the military, starting with JROTC in high schools and ROTC in colleges. And you don't see that level of involvement. Some say college. There are no college recruitment classes in high schools, but there are military recruitment classes in high school. So, you know, that putting that into perspective kind of boggles the mind, where we see how much latitude, the kind of latitude military recruiters get in high schools, and how much preferential treatment they get. So certainly this is evidence of how the preference and how military recruitment is prioritized in our high schools over other, you know, non-military colleges and so forth.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Let's get a teacher in this discussion, and a union activist. Joining us is Natalie Hirose. She's with the Teachers Union San Francisco and organizer with ANSWER. And Natalie, how would you characterize the school's role? Are they collaborators?
In terms of the war? Or?
In terms of getting kids, using the military to sort of suck kids in. Do schools play a key role in letting this happen, in encouraging? How does that...
Definitely. I mean, I think the school administrations definitely do. To some extent, you know, teachers take different positions, and many teachers are against the war and would never allow JRTC to be something they'd offer to children. But a lot of schools do bring in JRTC. The other thing is schools are very stuck. I mean, this relates very closely to the budget cuts and the firings that are going on, the lack of art and music and PE. So what they say when the administration brings in JRTC is, well, it's a PE credit, so we don't have to hire another teacher to teach PE. We don't have to provide another course so we can have JRTC in. And that's kind of the way they get it into the schools. But in the fourth and fifth grades, which is what I teach, the elementary schools, I think the schools are more complicit in not teaching the children about the war, not teaching them about the alternatives they have when they grow up to the military, the idea that they have to sort of choose the military because of their economic situation is things that kids who are 10 and 11 are already thinking, like, you know, I think I'm going to go into the Army. My older brother's in the Army. It's the only real choice I've got. I know I'm not going to go to college. I'm not going to get a job. And that is the way in which schools sort of disadvantage students by not giving them those economic opportunities. But that's a societal problem as well.
Tell us a little bit about, just as an organizer for ANSWER, tell us if people in the Bay Area want to participate, how can they participate?
There are actually, between now and Saturday, quite a few ways to participate. We're still preparing for the demonstration. If you're in San Francisco or you'd like to come into San Francisco, to our office, 2489 Mission Street, the corner of 21st and Mission. There are signs to be made. We'll be loading up the trucks tomorrow at 5 p.m. And people should come out to Justin Herman Plaza at 11 a.m. There's volunteer opportunities at the demonstration. As people know, these demonstrations are totally grassroots, so they're all volunteer-based. We're all volunteers. People should call 415-821-6545 to get involved.
All right, Marco, I want to come back to you, and because that's a frontline fight in terms of keeping the military away from the kids. Say a little bit more about that. I know you had other information you want to share with us as well.
Actually, yes. Yeah. So this Tuesday, March 24th, there will be a vote in the San Francisco School Board as to whether to extend the JROTC program or to, you know, stick with the 2006 decision to phase it out this June. So, again, that's going to be this Tuesday, March 24th, 6 p.m. at 555 Franklin Street in San Francisco.
So Marco, I want to ask you about what's it like to try and be in there and restrain the schools from doing this? What's that battle look like?
I mean, it's just been such a complex battle, and I don't know if folks are familiar. If the listeners are familiar with Proposition B, it was a policy statement introduced this past election cycle that basically stating for the school board to reinstate JROTC. And it was, instead of actually it being a purely JROTC issue, it was used as a wedge issue to influence the supervisorial race. So it was just this really nasty kind of underhanded campaign, and it was, even strangely enough, it was in addition to being sponsored by kind of pro-military forces, it was funded by the San Francisco Chamber of Commerce, the Association of Realtors. So there's all this kind of money and political kind of muscle.
So once again, the kids are being sold down the river for political reasons. We're going to leave it there with you, Marco. Because I want to get into the discussion. Chris Banks, a youth and student organizer with ANSWER. What are you hearing from the young people in terms of your organizing? And is there more of a sense that they have to question more what's happening with the military as they come into the schools?
Well, I appreciate the invitation to be on the show. Generally what I encounter is students who have already gone into political activity or motion as a result of the circumstances. So, for example, in January, when the United States and Israel were massacring the people of Gaza, there were almost daily protests, and they were really led by youth. And a lot of the youth had never gone out in the streets before, protested before. And so, and the same is true around the issue that has been discussed about the budget cuts to education, where a lot of young people for the first time, either because they're about to graduate or they're already in college or they have family members that are in college, and they're seeing the budget cuts and are starting to ask, you know, how come there's no money for education, but, you know, when we hear the news every day, there's billions and trillions of dollars for bailouts for, you know, rich people. And starting to ask the questions on their own, and it's usually at that point that I come in contact with them. And the young people are the most interested in struggling. I think that's why we see them kind of at the forefront over the last, you know, year especially, of all the different struggles, whether that was the struggle around the right to marry that exploded in November, again, the support for Palestine in January, and continuing into the demonstration this Saturday.
All right. Well, that's Chris Banks and the demonstration that he is talking about. There's actually going to be three around the country, a major protest in Washington, D.C., in Los Angeles. And for those of you in the Bay Area, there's going to be a march and a rally this Saturday. The march will assemble 11 a.m. at Justin Herman Plaza in San Francisco. That's Embarcadero. And the rally will take place at the Civic Center Plaza, that's City Hall. That will begin at about 1 o'clock, and KPFA, Pacifica Radio, will be broadcasting starting at 1 o'clock. I want to thank all of you for joining us on Flashpoints. We're going to be keeping an eye on the war. Thank you so much, Natalie, Chris, and Marco. Thanks for joining us, and Rowan, all of you. Good information. Important to have you with us, and maybe a lot of people listening now will meet you on Saturday. Who knows? You are listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. We're going to take it now to Palestine and the occupied West Bank. Nora?
In Berkeley, I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Israeli occupation forces conducted sweeping arrest campaigns across the main cities in the West Bank early this morning, targeting 11 politicians, including Hamas officials and elected members of the Palestinian Legislative Council. 9 Palestinian civilians were also kidnapped in West Bank raids by the Israeli military. The outgoing Israeli government said that it would, quote, increase the pressure on the Hamas party after indirect negotiations focusing on another prisoner exchange deal stalled. Palestinian political leaders said that Israel had made unacceptable demands to deport some Palestinian prisoners rather than releasing them back to their homes. There are over 11,000 Palestinian political prisoners languishing under torturous conditions inside Israeli jails and detention centers, most of them imprisoned without charge and arrested in sweeping raids in the middle of the night. Meanwhile, the Israeli daily newspaper Haaretz released a series of testimonies today from Israeli soldiers who had participated in the lethal 3-week assault on Gaza that began in late December. Operation Cast Lead killed over 1,400 Palestinians, including over 450 children, and wounding over 5,000. U.S.-made weapons, including white phosphorus, dime bombs, hellfire missiles, and flechettes, were unleashed on the 1.5 million Palestinians trapped inside the occupied Gaza Strip. These testimonies, according to Haaretz, run contrary to the Israeli military's own claims that it went to lengths to protect civilians during the siege. Several of the testimonies include first-hand admissions that Israeli soldiers knowingly shot and killed women and children. In one such account, during a home invasion, a soldier admitted he told a woman and her daughter it was safe to move and put them in the path of a sharpshooter sniper on their roof who killed them. A squad leader was reported as saying, quote, "We should kill everyone there in the center of Gaza. Everyone there is a terrorist." And finally, the Israeli Knesset is set to confirm Avigdor Lieberman as foreign minister under a Netanyahu-led cabinet. Lieberman, a Moldovan-born Israeli settler, gained popularity in Jewish Israeli society with his racist, hardline platform calling for Israeli citizens to take a loyalty oath to the Jewish state in exchange for basic civil rights, singling out indigenous Palestinian citizens of the state. He has also forcefully advocated outright ethnic transfer of Palestinian citizens of the State of Israel to a future so-called Palestinian state, And several years ago, Lieberman said he would purchase the buses to gather up all the Palestinians in Israel and take them to the Dead Sea to be drowned. Joining us to talk about the current political climate in Palestine and what the rise of Lieberman means for Palestinians inside the occupied territories and inside the Green Line is Dr. Mostafa Barghouti. Dr. Barghouti is a physician and a political leader in the West Bank. He ran for Palestinian Authority president against Mahmoud Abbas and was elected as a member of the Palestinian Legislative Council in 2006. He was Minister of Information in the short-lived Palestinian Unity Government in 2007. Dr. Barghouti, it's good to have you back with us today on Flashpoints.
Thank you.
So now I understand you're speaking to us from Cairo after the latest Unity Government talks have stalled yet again. Can you give us first an update from the talks that were just adjourned? Are Palestinians getting closer to a reconciliation agreement between Fatah and Hamas? What's going on with the Unity Government talks right now?
What we have done is, within the last 10 days, we've made a great deal of progress, and I think we managed to resolve several issues. Yet, there are some issues that have to be resolved, which have not yet been resolved, like the issue of the program of the government, the structure of the government, and how to reconvene the Palestinian National Council again, the Palestinian Legislative Council again, and how to have an interim unified Palestinian decision during the coming period. So we will have a break now, and we will reconvene next week, hopefully to finalize all the issues and to reach a national unity agreement that would bring back Palestinian freedom.
Dr. Mostafa, what are you most concerned about now that elected politicians inside the West Bank have been kidnapped and abducted by the Israeli military this morning, 11 officials? How does that affect the possibility of furthering unity government talks?
Well, in my opinion, exactly like in 2007, Israel is conducting a very dangerous policy, trying to prevent national unity again. I think there are two things that are terrible. First of all, they've failed successful agreement to exchange prisoners and have Shalit go back home and have 450 Palestinian prisoners released as well. At the last moment, I think Olmert abdicated his positions and practically destroyed the option, at least for the time being. And now they're conducting civil arrests, including widening the list of members of parliament and ex-members of Palestinian government. In my opinion, this is an intentional escalation, partially directed at exercising more pressure on Palestinians, partially directed at trying to prevent the Palestinian national unity. And definitely this is one way of the Israelis saying that they are not planning to lift the embargo and siege in Gaza, which is nothing but a continuation of war in Gaza, which needs help and support to reconstruct the huge damage that the Israeli army has created.
That's the voice of Dr. Mostafa Barghouti speaking to us from Cairo. Dr. Barghouti, Israel is set to confirm Avigdor Lieberman as their foreign minister. This is a man who openly advocates ethnic transfer and extermination of the indigenous population. He lives in an illegal settlement colony inside the occupied West Bank. You know, he has captured the growing racist sentiment of Israeli society, unfortunately. Can you give us some background on Lieberman and what his appointment as foreign minister means for Palestinians inside the Green Line and in the West Bank and Gaza Strip?
It's not just the election of Avigdor Lieberman. It's the whole trend in Israel, which has shifted more to the right, more to extremism. It's not just a shift to the right, actually. It's a shift to extremism, to racism, to consolidation of an apartheid system. This is the new government that is coming with Netanyahu and Lieberman and Sharpito. Is declaring clearly that it has no intention whatsoever to accept the solution, or to accept peace-based interstate solutions. So it's a real government. It's a government against peace. And Lieberman in particular is nothing but a neo-fascist. He is advocating ethnic cleansing publicly. He is advocating that he would conduct more wars in the Middle East. And he is running a very clear racist policy against Palestinians. The problem is that this man will be in charge of anything called peace process in the future, because he will be the foreign minister of Israel. And this party is going to hold some of the most vital portfolios, like the internal security cabinet or the infrastructure cabinet, which means his party will be able to conduct intensive widening of, and escalation of settlement activities, as well as he will be probably preventing any possibility of continuity in the West Bank. So I think this is a declaration of war, and what the United States cannot keep hiding from this challenge. The United States supports two-state solution and supports peace based on two-state solution. It cannot allow this government to just go on as if nothing has happened.
And Dr. Bogudi, what about regional governments? How will Lieberman's appointment affect the ongoing occupation of Syria's Golan Heights, for example, the relations with Egypt, where you are right now? Can you talk about the regional implications for this racist appointment of foreign minister?
In my opinion, a country like Egypt has very great difficulties in receiving him or talking to him, because this man was advocating bombarding the high dam in Egypt, which means he was advocating bombarding Egypt and flooding the country. Such statements, of course, reflect how racist it is. And I think it will be very difficult for Egyptian politicians or any other politicians in the region to have business with such a man or to meet with such a man. That's why, but the issue is not just Lieberman, it's also Netanyahu. Netanyahu is failing to have coalition government because he refuses to accept the principle and the idea of two-state solution.
And finally, let's get into the current situation inside Gaza and the West Bank right now. First off, what's your response to the admissions of outright war crimes and crimes against humanity by the Israeli occupation soldiers who participated in the 22-day assault on Gaza? You know, coming at a time when more and more international legal bodies and members of civil society are pushing the international courts to condemn Israeli officials and convict them for war crimes. What can you say about what happened in Gaza and the evidence for war crimes that continues to be revealed right now?
War crimes were conducted in Gaza. I think the evidence is very powerful and very clear. There were several investigation commissions and committees that have come up with clear proof of how terrible the crimes were. The use of forbidden weapons is well documented, including white phosphorus for dying weapons. The fact that the Israeli army intentionally targeted civilians, intentionally killed civilians for no reason, and intentionally prevented provision of medical care to civilians, and then intentionally that were trying to provide medical care to the civilians, all of this is well documented. So the war crime has happened. What is different today is that in addition to the journalists who wrote about it, the international independent committees that came to investigate it and reported it and are reporting it now. In addition to all of that, today we have very clear statements by Israeli soldiers themselves reporting that they were asked or they were allowed to conduct criminal attacks on civilians. This is coming from the Israeli army itself. Then I think one does not need any more proofs there. And still we do not see, at least from the official level, any serious move from the international community against this terrible war crime that has happened in Gaza. I think the whole legitimacy and the whole credibility of the international community is at stake today, because if Israel is allowed to continue to behave as if it is above law and above international law and above that it is imperative to international humanitarian law, then I think we're talking about very serious matters. And many countries will definitely make very serious conclusions out of it.
All right, we're going to leave it right there. That's the voice of Dr. Mostafa Barghouti, a leading Palestinian politician. You're also a physician and founder of the Union of Palestinian Medical Relief Committees. You've been speaking with us from Cairo. We're going to let you go because I know that you're really busy. But thank you so much for being with us again on Flashpoints.
Thank you. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. And that wraps it up for another edition of Flashpoints, which airs every weekday and is produced by Dennis Bernstein and Nora Barrows-Friedman. Our contributing producer is Robert Knight, and our technical director is Eric Klein. Our Friday co-host is Francisco Herrera, Miguel Molina is our roving producer, and JR and the Block Report contribute to this program. To comment on today's program, please contact us at dbernstein@igc.org. Look us up on the web at www.flashpoints.net for our archived shows. Dozens of affiliate stations across the country broadcast Flashpoints on a regular basis. Please email us your call letters and Flashpoints broadcast schedule at dbernstein@igc.org, and we'll add you to our website. Many thanks to our web team, and thank you for listening.
It is 11 o'clock, and you are listening to KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland, 91.9 FM in Hood River, 100.7 FM in Corvallis and Albany, and you can find us on the web at kboo.fm. Up next, it's Boneheads and Bigots. Stay tuned to KBOO.
Good morning and welcome to Boneheads and Bigots. And we're on at a new time and we're on at a new week, but it's the same old me. And it's the same old Todd. I'm sorry. Hey, Todd, I forgot. Now, this is my fault because Todd had a show 2 weeks ago and I forgot all about it. So, Todd, you need to give us more. First of all, you need to give us more notice next time. So this is all your fault. And second of all, you have to tell us how your show was.
It went well. Yeah, it was the first show I've done in a year. Other than just like cameo appearances or getting up on stage with somebody else. But it was nice because I have a whole, you know, I have like 45 minutes to an hour of material that's memorized, and it's always good to stand up in front of people and practice it to keep it in my memory. So if, you know, something ever happens where I can drop everything and go on tour and make some money, I'm ready for it, you know?
And so maybe you could tell us, Todd, what kind of performance this is?
We'll continue to perform because every day is the norm. Like a storm, I'm coming down with some lightning. Not frightening or scary, just continue because, you know, I'm wary of all the fear. It's time that we listen here. We see clear with our own eyes. See and do, continue to follow through because it's never through. But it's up to you because it's all in what we do. It's all in what we say. So I got to keep it on play each and every day. But anyway.
Now tell us, what name do you perform under?
Solar One.
Okay. And are you going to perform again soon?
Most
do you have
definitely.
Anything booked yet?
I have some friends. They're having some shows that said to show up, so I'm just staying in the practice. And, nothing booked right now. I have some tentatively booked shows, but I'm not going to say anything because
okay.
It could change.
So what have we learned from this today, Todd? You will give us more notice in the future? And you will tell us more often?
I'm an entrepreneur, so I'm doing a million different things at the same time. So I focus my energy on a few. And whatever seems to be, you know, whatever opportunities or doorways open up to me, I kind of go down that for a while, but stay true to everything else that I'm doing. But I try not to take on too much. But, you know, I'm an artist, so I do a lot of painting. So I have art shows, and then I have music. And I try to keep something going. So, like I said, if something's not really, you know, working out, I can focus on something else. And then I can come back to it with fresh energy, so...
Okay, so Todd will tell us the next time he's going to play, so we have more lead time so we can let everybody know. Because, frankly, I put it in my... Here's what happened. We did last show last month with Seneca the Librarian, and I put the card in my library book. And then I took my library book back. Because I'm all about maintaining my library status, so I can't have any overdue books. So, but that I'm glad you said that about... keeping things, you know, sort of having many irons in the fire, so to speak, because that has to do with something I was thinking about this week, actually thinking about change, because there's been so much change lately. Of course, there's been great change. There's been this just radical change with the change of our administration, political administration. There's also been all kinds of economic change. Seems like every day I turn on, like, the news or listen to the radio or the TV or something in the news or read something, and it's like something completely radically a radical element of change has happened. Like, you know, newspapers that I never thought would go out of business are going out of business right, left, and sideways. There's change in this administration. There's change in all this economic stuff. You know, every day it's like sometimes it's like Chicken Little where, like, the sky is falling. Every time I turn the TV on or listen to the radio where it's just mainstream news, I'm sometimes flinching like, you know, oh, I don't even know what's going to come across next, but is it going to freak me out? So... I was thinking about how people deal with change and also change. I have a new person in my life who's super awesome. So that kind of change makes me super excited, of course, and everyone else, romantic change. But dealing with the whole issue of change is there's so many different things about it. It's almost like a shedding of skin, and that's also very, very, can be very difficult to deal with. And the way people around you react to change can have so much effect on your ability to change. And I wanted to say to a couple of people, I wanted to say hi to Chris and Don, their new listeners, and they're going through some changes right now. They lost somebody in their family recently. And then also wanted to say hi to my friend Mark, who he and Julie had change with. They have a new member of their family recently. A lot of change going on there. A baby affectionately I call Cool Whip Ginsburg. But it's interesting to talk about change because you think about it in, it's almost in a reverse order of how things normally work. Change starts usually with an ending, and then there's sort of this neutral zone, and then there's this new beginning. And there's also a period, I think, before that new ending where you're trying to think about the transition or something is bugging you. It's almost like there's a rock in your shoe, that feeling where, like, or your shoes don't fit or your pants are too small or too big, where you've got that feeling like something is not quite right. And you're just kind of going on with your life, but there's something at the back of your mind that's like, something is wrong with my shoe and I've got to fix it, or I've got to think about fixing it, or something's going on. So there's that sort of period up to the ending. And then the actual ending itself seems to be like it's the beginning of this transitional period. And that's when you're actually really taking your first steps. You know, you're going to give up an old habit. You've lost a friend. You've lost a family member. You have a new family member. You've changed your job. You've lost your job. If you have a 401k retirement plan, you open up the envelope every month and you realize, like, whatever happened, AIG owns half of it. All of these things, like, something's always happening, something gets given up. Even if there's new opportunity and change, there's also something else that you end, like you end old behavior, you end old relationships, you move jobs, or you lose your job, you stop hanging out with the same people that you see almost as much as you would see those of friends and family members. So there's all these unexpected sort of ripple effects from the ending that you don't expect are happening to you. I think that's in itself a very difficult period, because you think, I tend to think that change is just this thing, you know, I'm going to go get a new job or something, and then that's just a thing, and then everything else is going to just fall out, you know, nicely from it. There's all of these sub things that happen to it that you just don't even expect, and some of those things can just hit you, you know, right between the eyes, and particularly when, say, for example, you're, you know, ending a relationship. Those are the things really where you're dealing with a pretty sad event or a pretty big transitional event, and then all of a sudden there'll be something like, the one that would always get me is hearing the song on the radio, or going to a club or something, hearing that one song that meant something, that was your song or whatever. Yeah. I always thought it was very helpful to break things at the end of relationships, like satisfying things, like, you know, going to the Goodwill and getting some vinyl that you didn't care about so you could break it. That was very satisfying. I broke a TV once. I dropped it out of a window. That was very satisfying because the thing imploded on the inside. I highly recommend that. What did I see on a TV show recently where it was a guy was offering 20 minutes of, it was, the store was called Rage or something. Did you see that, Todd? Have you seen that?
Nah, but in Spain, they let a bunch of people demolish a building.
Why can't we do that?
Right?
Why can't we do that? For example, there's probably some two needs that can be met there, right? Like here, we probably need to demolish a building. And we have people who don't have jobs who need to let out some steam. And there's probably people who have bats that would like us to test them out. So if we could just triangulate all of those things, then we could do the Rage thing. That would be awesome. Okay, Todd, copyright that so nobody steals this idea.
All right. Okay. All right. Yeah, I think visualizing change, like visualizing yourself in the future is something that's really important for being where you want to be, I feel like. Because mm-hmm. I know when I have that clarity and I'm like, okay, you know, I have a goal to work towards, whether it's a show, and it's like, okay, I have to memorize all these lyrics by this day. And then I do it, you know, it gives me a goal to work towards. Right. Or if I get an art show and it's like, okay, I have to finish all of these paintings on this day, you know, and I usually do it. I always hang up wet paintings, but it forces me to finish things.
That's true. And by the way, speaking of artists, if you get a chance to go down to Burbadi's downtown, has an art show in there right now that a good artist is in there. Her name is Mona Superhero, and she does duct tape art, and she has a couple of pieces hanging up there right now, and she does duct tape art, so she never hangs up any wet art. She hangs up sticky art, but she doesn't hang up any wet art. But some really cool new pieces are up there, and I think that's true. That's definitely true, to have some kind of outward goal, some objective goal, really helps you move along better. Which reminds me that recently, this is a weird phenomenon, especially with all this economic issues. It's kind of a stream of consciousness half hour today. But I recently ran across an old friend of mine who had come into some money and had some sort of issues anyway, had maybe a little bit of a drinking issue, a little bit of maybe some mental health issues. But the money and the of what some would think would be the great opportunity never to really have to work at this point, really sort of unmoored this person. And in this economic time, you know, I mean, I have always had this idea sometimes when I drive on the freeway and you see that sign that's the one about the lottery where it's like, you know, 55 million and counting. And I always think to myself, wow, wouldn't it be awesome if I won the lottery? And sometimes I even close my eyes. So if you see me on the freeway, try give me a big bubble. But I worry about that in some respects because you get all of this money and money does change everything. And this person, it was very, very strange to talk to this person because I would have thought to myself, what a great opportunity you could just read or study or do art or not really have to worry about your economic stuff. And this person was just kind of lost. So I think that probably the thing to happen is if you are in that position that you could send your money to me and I would become your life coach. That's another thing that I've recently come across is people who are advertising themselves as life coaches. Which that sounds, isn't that kind of like what your therapist should do? I mean, that seems to me like that's what your therapist should do. But okay, so we were talking about change when I kept changing all the topics here. But so we're talking about the ending part, which is the beginning, right? Technically. And then you've got this weird limbo, this neutral zone, right? Where you're trying to sort of shed the skin of the old and move on to the new experience. And that can be really frustrating because nothing is comfortable. So instead of the analogy with the rock in your shoe, now say you've got two different colored shoes, different styles, and both of them don't fit. That is how that feeling, that neutral zone feels to me. Every once in a while, you have this period in the middle of that one where you feel like, oh, I'm really going to hit my stride. I'm really hitting it. I really feel like, oh, this change is going to be great. And then, invariably, like 10 minutes later, you're having a miserable experience navigating the limbo, or the day later something completely falls apart. So that, I think, that period is typically sort of an up and down as you kind of establish a new biorhythm or something like that. There's also something in that period that where you're kind of mourning your old life or the thing that you lost, or even if it's a positive change, you still think about, or still things still evoke memories about what you had to give up to start this change. So I think during that period, it's really important to talk to people, about how you're feeling, to process the whole experience, because if you don't, you kind of lose all of this great opportunity to learn from yourself when you're going through the middle of all of this. It's almost like, the whole point in the, you know, when you're in the desert trying to get through it. That's the important part. And then the experimenting also. You get all this information during your that limbo, and you look at all of your options, and you're starting to go down a path and realize that's not the right one, and you go down another. And Dodd, is that sort of, I'm going to ask you another art question. How do you deal with that kind of stuff when you're in the middle of that, say, in an art project? How do you deal with, when you're painting, how do you deal with sort of experimenting with going one way in an art project, and then when do you figure out that that's not right and you have to stop and retrace your steps?
Through the whole process, yeah. It's part of the process.
Mm-hmm.
It's everything, you know, I'm constantly forced to adapt.
Mm-hmm.
And so if something doesn't work, with painting it's easy because I can let it dry and paint over it. You know? But it's, you know, through my life I've been kind of forced to be able to adapt to change around mm-hmm. me. And it's something that, you know, as you go, you just kind of change what you're doing and see what works, what doesn't work, mm-hmm. and then stick with that. And, you know, the painting, like with painting, it kind of evolves on its own.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like I'll put a layer down, and then sometimes I won't know, you know, what I want to do next. So I have to kind of walk away from it, work on another painting or do something else, come back to it. And then I have fresh energy. I can see it with different eyes and be like, oh, this is what I need to do. You know, I need to fix this and fix this or change this. Or I might look at it and go, wow, it looks good. It's perfectly fine. I don't have to do anything else to it. So, you know, it's kind of like sometimes when you're in the middle of something, it's hard to see the overhead view. You know what I mean? And
right.
So if you have that ability, or you can learn to use that ability to kind of pull yourself, you know, and get
back up
pull yourself back exactly out of the experience and look at it from the outside perspective, you might be able to see it from a different you know, a different perspective and change what you're doing.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I've always thought about that, especially with visual art, is where do you know or when do you know that you're done and when do you know where you have to stop or not stop, but where you have to shift gears, where you have to make change. And this was interesting. I saw this documentary the other night on, which I'm totally into documentaries, but I saw this documentary on Thomas Hart Benton, who is an artist. And he was an artist during the early 20th century. He was Jackson Pollock was one of his students in the Midwest, and he was an artist in New York for a while and then moved back to the Midwest and then always was sort of fighting with the New York art scene. But he was fighting against also coming up in a very political family. His grandfather was Senator Thomas Hart Benton, and he sort of went off, in, you know, according to his family, went off the rails and became a visual artist. And lived in Paris, and I think had a mistress, which made him quite the rogue in like the, you know, 1900 or so to his Midwestern family. But he went to New York and did some sort of American, he was sort of a beginning of this American Midwestern style of art where it was bigger than life, pictures with, you know, all of these mythologies and stories crammed into one. So there would be a, you know, picture, there would be a visual image of, you know, corn threshing, and then right next to it would be visual images of, like, train tracks and, you know, discovering and navigating the West. And he would do these large murals, and he would just cram all of these things in there, and he would experiment with the horizon lines so that there were all these different horizon lines in the paintings so he could actually get all of these different images together. It's, and when I looked at some of those, I thought, I don't know if any of you remember the shoe stores. It used to be known as Kenny's that was in Lloyd Mall. This is quite an offshoot. But one of the things that always used to strike me when I walked by there is like they would just cram every shoe that they had for sale into the window with the hope that one of them would catch your eye and you would come in. And so Thomas Hart Benton's murals were something like that, where it was just everything he could think of that was like really important about the story of America, solid America, and how he described it as America really happens in the middle. It's not America at the edges on, you know, New York and San Francisco. He said those are the borders. America's in the middle. And so if you look at some of his art, it's some amazing, it's almost like the murals a little bit like Diego Rivera did, but much, much more kind of a fluid style to them. But the reason why I thought about him is he went to New York and did these murals and got some acclaim from them, experimented in a bunch of different styles and copied all these different people and impressionists, and he was horrible at all of that stuff. And then he does this one mural, gets a lot of positive reinforcement from it, and then he moves back to the Midwest and he sort of never changes his style, but never really moves past and gets creative again. Like he's created a little safe kind of bubble for him, and almost all of the critics who write about him say, you know, it's too bad that he never got there again. So that's also my other interesting thing for visual artist people is, you know, how do you force yourself, sorry to put you on the spot, Todd, all half hour long, visual artist example one, but how do you put yourself on the spot to always push the envelope, to always force the creative process? Because that's a very challenging and fearful process and can make, I mean, frankly, that just makes you tired. That stuff makes you tired. You can't do that every minute of every day.
True, yeah. Well, that's, you know, I try to, the way my life has worked so far, I work a lot for a couple years, few years, save money, and have been able to travel. I've been to India, I've been to Costa Rica, Guatemala,
you're that
Mexico,
guy that's got
Hawaii,
money.
Alaska.
Todd, I need your money to be your life coach.
No, I don't have money. See, I do this without money. That's the amazing part of my life, that I'm really, you know, it's like I'm able to pull it off, and I'm not in a huge amount of debt. I have a small credit card. Yeah, so basically traveling cheap. You know, when I go to Costa Rica, I camped out. When I went to Europe, I knew people that just offered me places to stay, you know, and then youth hostels were pretty inexpensive. You just have to, you know, take earplugs if you're going to sleep in the dorm to, you know, block out the snoring and the people coming in at 3 a.m. or whatever.
Yeah, I think, so that's the, so back, you didn't really answer my question.
Well, that's
though.
My inspiration, you know, like by putting myself in these situations.
Oh, okay.
Like I went to Costa Rica and surfed for 4 months and then went there another time and surfed for 2 months. And so I traveled, I met people, I took my sketch pad, I drew what I saw, you know, like, I had money saved up, it was cheap to live, so I could wake up, you know, camp out for $2 a night where I had a shower, I had other people camping out around me from all over the world, that were, you know, in similar situation, travelers, would wake up, you know, drink some yerba mate, soak some oats in water, go surf, come back, eat the oats, sit around, drink some more mate, draw, go walk around, do whatever I had to do during the day, you know, when the onshore winds start coming, and then go back out in the afternoon, you know, maybe go swim in a waterfall or something. It was an easy life. I almost stayed down there.
And so if people are listening to this at work, when you're on your computer, at home on your computer right now, you probably, like, clicked open another window, tickets to Costa Rica. Thanks, Todd.
Yeah, but then when I got back, you know, I got busy. And it was one of the things that motivated me. Same as when I went to Hawaii. It's like I had all these drawings, and then I was like, whoa, I need to get back home where I have paint, you know, and canvases and, you know, a roof over my head where I can do this stuff. And so come back and, you know, hopefully things get going. Sometimes, you know, it's a little, the transition can be a little rough, but usually
that's precisely my point. Oh, gosh, I love how everything's coming around to my point. And I don't even have to draw it. But that's, I mean, so that's what I was watching this documentary with Thomas Hartbitten, and I thought, there's a guy that, you know, did a lot of work to get to this sort of right on the edge moment where he really kind of his creativity blossomed, and then for whatever reason, you know, that was too much of a precipice for him to be there on a regular basis. And kind of, and so I thought to myself, which I think this with creative people, when I'm reading about them or watching documentaries, how do they feel if they actually have knowledge of that? Because if you don't know that you're kind of cutting your creative juices short, you could probably live very well and do very well. And, you know, if you're not smart enough to know that you're being a coward in some respects, that's how I guess I'm putting a moralistic judgment on that one. But it seems to me that if you have the opportunity to be creative in whatever point in your life, you should be pushing that envelope, that's you have a moral duty to do it. And I'm not sure if that's appropriate judgment to make, but it seems to me that is the right one. So anyway, we were just talking about change. That's the part, the neutral zone, where you're experimenting, right? As Todd says, you're surfing, and you're doing yerba mate all the time, which, by the way, I have had, and I do not like that. But then, at the very end of this process is this new beginning, right? You've sort of accomplished getting to a certain point. Then you can kind of create new goals. You can sometimes settle in and see how this one fits, you know? You've gotten to the point where your shoes actually do fit, and now you just get to walk in them and see what they're like. You get new relationships. You get, you know, new ways to use your time. You know, you develop all these different resources to deal with the new change in your life. And so, when you look at it, people say, you know what, the only constant is change. But it's interesting how much we resist change so much in our lives. You know, we want change, we resist it. Comfort, familiarity. I bet you can't throw a rock from where you're sitting right now without hitting somebody who's in a crappy relationship because they don't want to deal with the change of it. And do that for a very long time. Or they're in a really uncomfortable, unhappy work environment. I can certainly, you know, plead guilty to that one for a long time. But if you think about it, like Todd was talking about, if you have the ability to take a step back, and so you can look at the bigger picture, And if you have a lot of stuff going on in your life, maybe that's when, you know, your kids are in the bathtub or something, and you actually have 1 minute to yourself where you can actually think about the bigger picture. You could actually revel in the chaos that is involved in the process of change. Sure, I mean, it may suck if you have a new kid and there's nothing but dirty clothes and food everywhere, and you just feel like you haven't been able to get out of your sweatpants and go talk to an adult human for weeks at a time. But really, when you think about it, at the back end of this experience will be so much stuff you've learned. And everybody that has a kid wants to come here and stab my eye out right now for that perspective. They're like, yeah, right, it's easy to say you're not in the middle of this. But the chaos can be so exhilarating if you can experience it without the terror that's involved with it. So it seems to me that the strategies involved with the change are, you know, accepting being in this limbo, in that neutral zone. Don't let yourself get kind of trapped in it, trapped in the ennui by, you know, not doing anything or sort of killing time by watching bad, meaningless TV, which has its place, but not when it's being used to keep you from thinking about things or doing things. The same thing with like eating too much, drinking too much, doing too many drugs, that kind of stuff. That's all symptomatic of like there's something going on, but you don't really want to deal with it at that particular time. So now is the time for you to like avoid being trapped in that limbo. Find something to do. Make sure that you're actually getting, I know this sounds corny, but make sure you're getting sleep. I mean, that's really hard to do. Your mind sometimes seems like it never stops spinning. Sometimes I feel like when I'm really, when I'm puzzling about a thought, but that's fun to feel the gears of your mind working. But when you're really just sort of obsessing about something, it's like there's a gerbil in a habit trail in my head where my brain is, and it's just running endlessly with no reason. Yes? Yes, Todd? The chair recognizes Todd.
I was just going to say, that's one thing that meditation is good about, is and that's really kind of the focus of meditation.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been getting into it a lot lately and actually teaching it in a lot of my classes. But it's looking at and observing the thoughts as they pass through the mind. Mm-hmm. And not really, you know, it's like, I like to see it as a river. You know, your mind, your consciousness is like a river, and there's thoughts that are boats flowing down the river, and you can observe them and watch them go past. You don't necessarily have to get on and entertain, you know, everybody on each boat that comes past, you know.
That's an interesting concept. And actually, the whole idea, the whole concept of meditation is one that I would like to understand better, but I always get very frustrated when I try to practice it because I'm bored.
Yeah, that's basically what it is. It's learning how to be okay with being bored.
Mm-hmm. Which, you know what, I think, and we're almost out of time here, but I think we have a couple more minutes left, but one of the interesting things about taking yourself out of your usual environment is the ability to experiment with what you do when you don't have a list of things to do all the time. Or, you know, in your regular day, you wake up and you have all these things that you have to do just to maintain the you know, corporation, to use that analogy, of who you are. You know, you have to do all this feeding and all this, you know, watering of yourself, and then get yourself to all these places to do your economic things, and then interact with your friends and family who nourish you spiritually, and all of your personal stuff, and all that stuff can sometimes just be detritus. And if you could take yourself out of that space, that's why traveling, I think, is really useful, and why people love it so much, is you are out of your element. You are in this constant state of changing chaos, and you're kind of alone in that process. And you can all, you know, you're always going to be able to spend some time with your thoughts. It's almost like when you solve problems in your sleep. Do you do that, Todd? Have you ever had the experience where you wake up and there was this problem bothering you, and you've solved it in your head?
I have dreams that when I wake up, I feel really good, and it gives me energy to go accomplish some things. And yeah.
Yeah, that's sorry. Your dreams aren't as cool as mine. I have dreams where I can fly.
All right, we have 10 seconds.
Anyway, so on that great note,
lucid dreams.
I encourage everybody to have patience with yourself and grace when you're in the middle of dealing with change. And we have lots and lots of boneheads to talk about next month. Next month, I'm going to talk about this new phenomena called the biblical womanhood, the Christian patriarch movement. And there's a great book about it. And anyway, I wanted to thank Todd again for engineering the show. And I wanted to thank Chris and Dawn again for being new listeners. And we will talk to you next month, third Friday of the month, 11 a.m.
This KABU program has been made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Gazelle Natural Fiber Clothing and Full Circle Resale. Full Circle is now accepting like-new natural fiber clothing, jewelry, accessories, and curios. Gazelle and Full Circle Resale are both located at the corner of Northeast 41st and Fremont and can be reached at 503-284-4192.
This KABU program has been made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Laurelhurst Theater and Pub, independently owned and operated, featuring modern, independent, and classic films, microbrews, pizza, and all-new seating, located at East Burnside and 28th in Portland, 503-232-5511 or laurelhursttheater.com.
Good morning. My name is Ed Goldberg. I'm here with my friend and colleague, D.K. Holm. For those of you who are missing Dawn Taylor, Dawn has decided to concentrate on commercial radio, so she will not be with us in the future. Do you have any announcements, Doug?
Yes, we're airing this show at a new time and date. if you're listening to it, then you already know, but if you can tell other people that Movie Talk has moved to Fridays at 11:30, the first and third Friday of the month, that would be great.
I have a couple of things to talk about at the Film Center. The Northwest Film Center is running the series on arts and artists, including a piece on Roy Lichtenstein on the 25th, and Ellsworth Kelly on the 25th. But here's a bunch of movies from their 70s series. Clute, March 26th, terrific movie. A Woman Under the Influence, a brilliant movie, March 28th. Lenny, a flawed but interesting film biography of Lenny Bruce. Five Easy Pieces, a great movie. And is this the movie that made Jack Nicholson a star?
I think so.
I think so, too. And Badlands. Those are early April. That's at the Film Center, 221-1156. Well, we have a few movies to do. Doug, give us the write-up on The Cake Eaters.
Yeah, so this is an independent feature directed by the actress Mary Stuart Masterson. And you may recall that I think at last year's film festival there was a movie called, oh, now I'm having a brain freeze on the title, but it was, I think it's called Away From Her, and it's directed by Canadian actress Sally, and I shouldn't have even brought it up because
right.
I couldn't even remember the thing. But anyways, Sarah Pauley, that's her name. So this seems to be two movies. We have a trend.
Mm-hmm.
Actresses turning to directing.
And, well, that's a good thing.
And their movies are surprisingly similar. Indie movies with eccentric casting and tinkling piano music or tinkling music as an accompaniment. Very slow-paced. Really like those New Yorker stories written by trust fund people who are writing about poor people, you know, describing their houses with their sway-backed clotheslines and their, you know, Mickey Mouse slippers and the old sofa in the back, in the front yard. This is the world portrayed in this movie. And like many screenplays, it is about a guy going back to his hometown because his mother has died. And the mother is the supposedly great Melissa Leo from Homicide and who was in Frozen River last year. And
you don't ever see her?
I guess he's great, but all you see her is in the credit sequence. Mm. Anyway, Bruce Dern is the patriarch of the family. Elizabeth Ashley is also in it as the mother of a disabled girl played by
Kristen Stewart,
apparently very popular Kristen Stewart. And a son ends up with that daughter, and a lot of secrets of life are revealed. and people get together and break up and get together, and it's all just a slice of life, and it's very calmly and methodically presented, and it's well acted. It's not the most interesting story in the world, and the people are not the sorts that you would really want to spend time with. And but you know, it could be that this is a movie that Kristen Stewart will be nominated for an Oscar for next year if it gets any attention because of the prejudices, the inclinations of the Academy to voting for people who play disabled people. So we'll see what happens. I wish I could quote Tropic Thunder at this juncture, but unfortunately I can't. So anyway, I give it a C plus or a B. It's fine work. It's just a little on the bland side and hues to those conventions that I, at least, perhaps others are growing weary of in these small-scale independent films.
Well, I agree with pretty much everything you said, although I think I liked it a little more than you, and I think the reason that the movie's better than it needs to be is because of the performances. You get a couple of pros like Bruce Dern and Elizabeth Ashley. They could do this movie in their sleep, but they didn't. They showed up and they hit their marks, and they were good. Elizabeth Ashley, especially in a role, gets a little more complicated than it seems to be at the beginning. Kristen Stewart, this movie was made 2 years ago. So this
has been around a while. Yeah,
it's been, so this is before Twilight and before all the other stuff she's been in. This was probably her highlight reel to get all those other jobs.
I think her first movie, she plays the kid in Panic Room.
That's correct.
Jodie Foster's daughter,
yeah. Aaron Stanford is in it. He was in one of the X-Men films as a fire-starting person. He plays the love interest, I guess, for want of a better term. This is a very well-acted movie without much of a story. You're absolutely right about that. But at least it won't insult your intelligence, like some of the movies we'll be discussing later on. I give it a B+, and I think it's kicked up a half a letter grade just because it stands in stark contrast to some of the crap I saw later in the week.
I believe it's playing at the Hollywood, and it starts shortly.
It might be there already. Okay,
yeah.
That's The Cake Eaters.
By the way, as far as I know, the title is never explained in the movie.
Is it? Let Him Eat Cake? I have no idea. Tell us about Everything for Sale. I didn't see this. So
this is another film by Andrzej Wajda, if I'm saying his name correctly, Wadja. And this is a movie made in 1969 at the height of society's rebelliousness, and at maybe about a year or a decade after the French New Wave began to impress people. It's a very new wavy feeling movie with lots of handheld camera work and kind of a bumptious plot. The premise of it is that it's a movie about people trying to make a movie, but the lead actor has disappeared, and in fact he's died. And in reality, the lead actor, the person who was going to be in it, actually did die, and they just went ahead and made the movie without him. His name was Zabolski, and you often see photographs of him, and he's considered the James Dean of Polish cinema. He made numerous movies in the late 50s, early 60s. He's very hardly known here, but Wajda loved him, or had ambivalent feelings about him, and wanted to make a movie about him, and the only way they could was to make a movie around him. So the movie is about people's relationship with this man who is gone. And it's very well acted. One thing that it's an influential movie. I think Kiarostami, the Iranian film director, later took a page from this movie to make couple of his films. As I'm watching more of these Wajda films, I'm realizing that he's a great filmmaker. He deserves his success and fame, I suppose, but he really is coming to seem to me a director of parts rather than the whole. I haven't seen a whole movie of his, except for the very early ones like Canal, where the whole movie is powerful. Instead, it's just parts of it. So this one, like some of the others we've seen lately, is a little uneven, but even the uneven parts are more fascinating than half of the supposedly good stuff that you could go out into a theater and see right now. So I give it an A, just because it's a Wajda, with the codicil that parts of it are not as interesting as other parts. Superbly acted, especially by the women actresses. There's three or four women characters in this movie that are not only well acted, but they're just interesting people, you know, and it was really a pleasure to see them. And there's one dance sequence that particularly stands out. So anyway, it's Everything's for Sale, or i.e. a fire sale. Let me quickly explain that the title comes from Wajda's throwing into this movie bits of movies that he'd rejected before, so it's a conglomeration of rejected set pieces. And it shows a little bit, but it's still pretty fascinating. That's Everything for Sale. It's at the Film Study Center tonight, so you got one chance to see it tonight.
Mm-hmm.
And it's pretty good.
It reminds me of Bela Lugosi dying in the middle of that Ed Wood movie. Huh?
Yes.
Okay, so that was Everything for Sale at the Film Center. Adventureland. Of all the comedies, this one actually stands out a little bit. It's directed by a guy named Greg Mottola, stars Jesse Eisenberg and... What's this? Kristen Stewart. Here's the story. This is Jesse Eisenberg is a young man who wants to go to New York. He's a college graduate, wants to go to graduate school in New York. They live in Pittsburgh. And he just wants desperately to go to New York and become a New York hipster and you know, learn the ways of wicked New York. And his family suffers an economic reverse. And not only can he take a for free internship that summer, but he may not be able to go to New York. So he gets a job in Adventureland, which is one of those theme park kind of a things. And it's the lowest of the low. He works games, which is, aside from being a janitor, is about as low as you can go.
And, this is in his hometown, not in New York.
It's in Pittsburgh, yes. And he meets a group of young people his own age, some of whom are nice and some of whom are awful and all of whom are funny and quirky, as you might suspect. Kristen Stewart is someone who takes him under her wing and she kind of shows him the ropes a little bit, naturally falls in love with her because it's Kristen Stewart.
Mm-hmm.
But she's got her own issues, including seeing a married man. So that causes a little bit of a ripple in the tide. This is very sweet and funny. It's not brilliant, but it's pretty good. And it's in the modern young adult romantic comedy. You know, the Nick and Nora's Infinite Playlist reminded me a lot of this. It's a similar kind of a theme with similar kind of people. And they resemble each other slightly. This is much better use of the formula than is common, especially nowadays. Very, very good work by Kristen Stewart Eisenberg and a young man named Martin Starr, who plays one of the other kids in the group. I kind of enjoyed this film. I give it a B. It's a solid B film. Doug, tell us about Absurdistan.
Yes, Absurdistan is a film by a guy who did a movie that appeared in one of the past film festivals called Tuvia or Tuava. Yeah, about a village. This one is, the director's name is Veit Helmer, an appropriate name for a director.
I was going to say, yes.
And it's one of the surprising things about it is that it's virtually silent. If it weren't for the narration that you hear, there's no dialogue in this movie. It's a Lysistrata story. It's a group of the women in the small, unknown, unheard of village want the water to come in through the pipes that from out in the Stanish desert. The men are too lazy to do anything about it, and so they go on strike and refuse sexual favors until something happens. Meanwhile, there's a love story brewing between a boy and a girl, and she won't have sex with him until he does something significant or it also helps. And he does, and they do, and the movie ends happily. But it's that kind of whimsical, wry, foreign movie humor that people laugh at the Film Study Center, but which I never find particularly funny. I didn't laugh at all. I didn't even smile while watching it. It was just something to be got through. And it was fine. It was very well photographed, interestingly acted. Everybody's very appealing. But it's whimsy, and whimsy is... you can make yourself laugh at it the way you can make yourself laugh at Shakespeare humor while secretly realizing that you're just faking it. You're just show that you're getting it. So I give it a C. I give it a C. It's pretty average stuff. I think you liked it a lot better than I did, though.
I did. I don't know whether it's my Romanian Russian background or anything, but this kind of absurd Balkan humor appeals to me, and also the what it says about the culture there, because. These are people that have a sense of self as being absurd, and I think that this comes out in their films. Black Cat, White Cat is my model for this. You and I have discussed this recently. Also absurdist, but Black Cat, White Cat is much more funny and anarchic than this movie is. This is a nice small movie with small goals that I think it meets all of its small goals very well. It's very, again, very slight, but very, very charming film. I thought it was a lot of fun. And the two young people, Christina Molitorova and Max Mouth, I thought were very appealing as the star-crossed lovers destined from birth to be together but thwarted by the lack of water in their silly little town. So that's called Absurdistan, and I think
that's another Hollywood
film, yes.
Theater film,
and
yes.
That'll be starting fairly soon there as well, so that's Absurdistan. Okay, I'm now about to embark on a great desert of filmmaking. I guess I really need to go through these things. Let's start with Miss March, which not only is the worst film of the year, but possibly of the decade. Here it is, 2009, and I finally found the worst film of the decade. Miss March is directed by two guys named Zach Cregger and Trevor Moore, who also star in the film. And here's the plot, if you can believe it. The Zach Cregger character and his girlfriend take a vow of chastity all through high school, and the night of their senior prom, she says, "Hey, forget the vow of chastity. Tonight's the night." And he says, "Cool." And the other guy is his best friend. This guy, if you can imagine Jim Carrey without depth or talent, that's this guy looks a little like a young Jim Carrey.
Some would say that Jim Carrey is a person, but I happen to like him.
I do too. I'll leave that up to you. But if imagine somebody that physically resembles him with zero talent. Okay, this kid is 6'5", weighs about 120 pounds. So, in any case, what happens is his friend gets him drunk, and on his way up to the bedroom to be with his girlfriend, he falls down the stairs and goes into a coma for 4 years. When he wakes up from the coma, his girlfriend is posing naked in Playboy, and thereby hangs this alleged tale.
Yes.
So what they decide that he and his friend, they're going to drive out to the Playboy mansion, and they're going to confront her and ask why she did what she did. Oh, how have you done me wrong? When the best thing in your movie is a cameo by Hugh Hefner, you know that you're in deep trouble. I can only imagine they got the funding for this film from Hugh Hefner, because it's like an infomercial for Playboy magazine and the whole Playboy lounge lizard scene.
What is the current obsession with Playboy all of a sudden?
No idea.
There's several movies, documentaries going on.
This movie is stupid, sexist, racist, misogynist, homophobic, and on top of all that, boring. It manages to be all this stuff and boring. I gave it an F-. I couldn't think of a grade to give this film. Stay away from it in droves. Sunshine Cleaning, great disappointment in a way, directed by Christine Jeffs, spectacular cast. Amy Adams, Emily Blunt, who's also been around a lot, Alan Arkin, Jason Spivak, and Marilyn Rice Cube, any movie she's in gets my attention. In any case, I really, really wanted to like this movie, but it was written by software. You take a woman who's working at a job way beneath her talent and capability. You give her a sibling with problems, drugs or alcohol. You give her a son who's an outcast in his school because he's a little too weird and too smart. I know. Let's throw in a foxy grandpa, somebody like Alan Arkin. Oh, wait, it is Alan Arkin. and then you throw this in with some kind of thing to get everybody, some MacGuffin. This movie was assembled from parts from every indie movie in recent history. And the fact is, it was part of the people that produced this did Little Miss Sunshine.
Oh.
And they do everything, including the title, to try to tie that to this.
But
even this wonderful cast can't save this movie, which is also quite dull and preposterous. It's a C-. That's Sunshine Cleaning. Fanboys. This is almost the same plot as Miss March, except it's George Lucas and Episode 1 of Star Wars. It's directed by a guy named Kyle Newman. It's a bunch of friends who want to go and see this film, Episode 1, before it comes out, especially since one of them is dying of cancer. Ouch. And it's a road trip movie, and it's harmless and silly, but it's really not worth your time. If you feel like you really must see this movie, wait for it to come out on DVD. I give it a C-. This one was a slight ray of hope here. This is The Great Buck Howard. I'm kind of sorry you didn't see this film in a way, Doug. I would have liked to know what you thought of it. It's directed by a guy named Sean McGinley. It stars John Malkovich, Colin Hanks, who is, yes, the son of Tom Hanks, and Emily Blunt. Here she is again.
Uh-huh.
Another slight film, but this is at least more amusing, mostly due to the monster performance by John Malkovich. And this is, it's too bad that the movie's so small. I don't think that Malkovich's performance is great in comparison to the film. I just think it's a great performance. He plays a washed-up mentalist who hates the term magician. He's a guy who appeared on the Johnny Carson show 61 times and has not been asked back since. So he plays his little venues, you know, union halls and small towns with, you know, trying to raise money for something. And he goes and he reads people's minds. And he's very popular in a very, very small way. He manages to make a living. Colin Hanks is, again, a young man who needs a job desperately and drops out of law school because he hates it and becomes this guy's amanuensis, his road manager, his gopher, his whipping boy, whatever it is. And that's the story. The story is the two of them go around, and he develops an affection for Buck Howard, the great Buck Howard, and in the process meets Emily Blunt and kind of falls in love with her. And then something spectacular happens, which basically screws up everybody's life, and I won't tell you what it is because you might want to see the film. There are a lot of cameos in this film, including Conan O'Brien, and yes, Colin's dad, Tom, is in the film playing, guess what, his dad. And it's all right, you know, it's not bad. It's you could do worse with an hour and a half. It's not a long film. It's a B-minus film, no better than that. But compared to Miss March and Fanboys, it's Citizen Kane. Okay, we have...
That one starts at the Cinema 21, right?
That one starts today at the Cinema 21, yes. It's really, really worth seeing it for Malkovich's performance. And the way Colin Hanks is very so low-key, he almost disappears, but the way he plays off of John Malkovich. Doug, talk to us about America Betrayed.
Well, this is a movie that, from the sound of it, one might want to say, boy, I don't want to see that. And I think it's the reason is the climate. With Obama as president, everybody feels uplifted and a little bit better about the way the country works and maybe not so interested in reviewing the recent past. Specifically, this movie is about the Army Corps of Engineers and the problems that they created in New Orleans that led to the disasters after the Katrina storm. And the movie puts the brunt of the blame on bad planning there and make a cautionary note about how the Army Corps of Engineers do things in all across the country, not just Louisiana. So, you know, we're all living in peril of dams and rivers are going to bust and so forth. Anyway, so one kind of resists seeing it because you think you're just going to be seeing the same old stuff. But I was really surprised by this film, which is written and directed by somebody named Leslie Card. I don't know about his or her background, but
it's a her. She.
It's very well put together. And what's distinguishing about it is how much detail it goes into about this one really narrow aspect of a big problem, which is who are the Army Corps of Engineers, what did they do that was so wrong, and how they've managed to avoid being taken to jail or at least prosecuted. It's narrated by Richard Dreyfuss, who sounds exactly like Richard Dreyfuss. If you don't like his mannered way of speaking, well, he doesn't talk that much. It's mostly talking heads going, you know, clearly and methodically through the story from the beginning to the end and laying it out. And there's many, many interviews with people. So it's from all spectrums of the political, all ends of the political spectrum. So it doesn't come across as a, you know, something from the left criticizing the right or vice versa. It's just a bad story that needs to be told and needs to be rectified. I enjoyed it quite a bit. If you can enjoy something that's about the ruination of, you know, 200,000 people's homes. It's America Betrayed. It's also at the Hollywood. I give it an A.
I didn't like it quite that much, but I thought it was quite interesting. The thing that amazed me about this film is that they trace the unhappiness with the Corps of Engineers back 100 years.
Yeah.
And the Corps of Engineers was one of the first organizations formed after the founding of the Republic. And for a while, the only people who were appointed to the Corps of Engineers were the top two graduates from West Point. Well, that went away for a long time, and then it became a group of bureaucrats and bumblers. And there have been accusations of incompetence and corruption for 100 years in this organization. At first, it was just, you know, strictly military use. You know, you need a bridge built over a river during a war, you call the Army Corps of Engineers. Then they got into things like flood control, building levees, building bridges, building dams, and that's where the bad stuff began, because a lot of money was involved in these projects with very, very little oversight, and that of course, is a petri dish for bad stuff to grow on. California comes out as one of the worst places in terms of the potential danger for this, because they have so many levee and dam projects in the Central Valley, because it's a desert, so they need to dam up rivers and stuff to make vegetables grow in the Central Valley. It's malfeasance, it's incompetence, and it's corruption. It's been going on for a long time. Now, I found the film passionate and angry, but also somewhat one-sided. But so what? I mean, they give people from the other side a chance to defend themselves, and they don't do a very good job.
And they didn't even respond. They didn't show up.
Exactly. So, the thing about Dreyfus's narration is that it's very wry. You know, it's an accusatory in a low-key way. So you can tell it's not a neutral. You can tell that he disapproves of what's going on. I give it a solid B. I think it's worth seeing. It's not going to make anybody sleep better, I'll tell you that.
Well, let me make one more comment about it. Now that newspapers all across the land are dying off and turning into community newspapers at best with no international circulation, I'm beginning to wonder if movies like this are where journalism is going to end up going. There'll be fewer stories, but they'll be bigger, and they'll get more attention because they're done in a movie format. And maybe not just shown in theaters, but shown on websites. I don't know. If people go to see it, I would recommend staying through the credits, because it's a bleak story, and so far no justice has been visited on anybody. But after the credits start rolling, the movie begins to honor people who live in Louisiana and New Orleans who made a difference and managed to fix things, like rebuild schools and colleges and open medical clinics on the street under canvas tops. And so that's part of it, makes you realize that things can be done, things can be fixed. It's not all bleakness and darkness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but it requires our work on our part.
Absolutely, yes.
Yes. Give me a minute or so on a DVD you've seen recently that maybe people want to go out and buy.
Well, in line with the Vija, I keep having to hesitate before I say his name to make sure I get it right.
That sounds about right.
Speaking of that series at the Film Study Center, the Criterion Collection is coming out with one of his more interesting movies, of which is called Danton, about one of the less famous members of the French Revolution, played by... it's going to come to see. I always have these brain freezes right at the end of the sentence.
Not to worry.
But it's the big famous French guy that has the wine. It'll come to me later. Anyway,
Gérard Depardieu?
Gérard Depardieu, that's okay. God, thanks, Ed. If you weren't here, I don't know what the show would have. No proper nouns in it. Anywho, it's interesting because it's Vija's attempt to tell the story of what was going on in Poland through the French Revolution. And it's very well acted, very well done, really kind of contemporaneous in its style, even though it's set, you know, a couple hundred years earlier. Anyway, that's coming out from the Criterion Collection. It has all sorts of fun extras on it that help, you know, round out your experience. So that's Danton. That should be out, you know, I think, next week or the week after.
Thank you, Criterion Collection, for the job you're doing.
Absolutely.
With these old movies. Okay, let's run over the films we've seen. The Cake Eaters. It's okay. Everything for Sale, you like that.
It's good.
Yeah. Adventureland is bad but not terrible. It's just, you know, lukewarm. Absurdistan, I liked it more than you did, but it's a slight but amusing little fable of an absurd film. Miss March is the worst movie of the decade. Cross the street to avoid a theater that this is playing at, because you might catch something from it. Sunshine Cleaning, I wish this movie had been better. Fanboys, also lame, but not awful. The Great Buck Howard, the best of the bunch, I think. America Betrayed, worth seeing. So we'll see you the first Friday of April at 11:30. And thank you all for listening. Thank you.
program is made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Oregon Peace Works, presenting the 25th annual Give Peace a Dance benefit concert and auction, Saturday, April 11th, 6 p.m. at the Grand Ballroom in downtown Salem, with music by Linda Hornbuckle, Kate Sullivan, Jenna Summer-Smith, and political satire by Dr. Atomic's Medicine Show. Appetizers and desserts included, silent and oral auctions, and bar. Tickets at 503-585-2767 or OregonPeaceWorks.org.
This KABU program has been made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Gazelle Natural Fiber Clothing and Full Circle Resale. Full Circle is now accepting like-new natural fiber clothing, jewelry, accessories, and curios. Gazelle and Full Circle Resale are both located at the corner of Northeast 41st and Fremont and can be reached at 503-284-4192.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. My name is Don Jacobson, and the program coming up is Moving On. We're going to play some music right after the community calendar and the Workers' Independent News.
This is the community calendar for Friday, March 20th, the 79th day of 2009. Nautical twilight starts at 6:09 a.m. Pacific Daylight Time, with civil twilight at 6:44. Sunrise is at 7:13 a.m., with the midday transit at 1:18 p.m. Sunset occurs at 7:24 p.m. Civil twilight ends at 7:53, with nautical twilight complete at 8:28 p.m. The waning crescent crow moon rises at 4:28 a.m., setting at 1:16 p.m. The moon is new at 9:07 a.m. Thursday. Food Not Bombs provides free vegetarian food to everyday people in response to the artificially created socioeconomic conditions that facilitate poverty, war, and societal distress. Meals are served at 5:30 p.m. Fridays in Colonel Summers Park at Southeast 17th and Taylor. Saturdays and Sundays under the west end of the Morrison Bridge. Mondays at Peninsula Park Rose Garden at North Albina and Ainsworth. For more information, email pdxfnb at lists.riseup.net or go to foodnotbombs.net. Oregon State Representative Chuck Riley of District 29 returns with his third Saturday coffees this Saturday. Constituents of Cornelius, Forest Grove, and Hillsboro are invited to come and talk about the current legislative session from 9:30 to 10:30 a.m. at BJ's Coffee, 2834 Pacific Avenue in Forest Grove. Questions? Email thecoordinator1@gmail.com. or call 503-992-7125. PDX Food Not Lawns and the Gorilla Gardening Association is giving free pea starts to anyone who's interested in tearing up their lawn for use as a garden space. New gardeners only, please. On a case-by-case basis, there may be some help removing your sod. For more information and details, email johndoe9129@yahoo.com or call 503-438-4093. This is Randall with the Friday Calendar. Thank you for listening to and supporting KABU Community Radio, radio of the people, by the people, and for the people of Cascadia. Happy trails, everyone.